good morning and welcome to another Tice Talk. It is Thursday, 10 o'clock in the morning, therefore we are live for today's Tice Talk. We're live every Thursday at 10 and every Tuesday afternoon at 4, where my co-host Jenny Radcliffe takes the stage, covering all the key topics in cybersecurity, diversity, ransomware, working from home, the lot. Welcome back to those of you who've joined us before. Welcome to the new people. If you like the Tice Talks, do please spread the word. Invite your friends, invite your family. As I say, every Thursday morning at 10, every Tuesday afternoon at 4. You can also watch it on catch up. What would be the point of that? You're here live. So welcome to all of you. My name is Jeff White and I'll be your host for today. We are also going to be giving away, excitingly, as we do every week, a Tice Talk mug. We're going to be giving away a Tice Talk mug. Now, normally there's a news story that we talk about, you know, during the course of the program at some stage. I'm going to flag that news story up today. Or somebody's already spotted that I don't have a bow tie on. Again, the reason for that will become clear when I welcome my first guest. But I'm going to give the free mug away today to somebody who can come up with something. We've got a news story we're going to be discussing, which is about the Queen hiring a cybersecurity specialist. So the royal household has put out an ad to hire a cybersecurity IT manager. So I'm going to give the mug away to whoever can come up with the best royal-themed cybersecurity pun or gag or joke. I've been trying to think of some myself and I can't give an example. So put your thinking caps on. Whoever gets the best royal-themed cybersecurity pun or gag gets the mug. So we're also going to be talking today about cybersecurity recruitment in general. How to get into the industry, how to pull people into the industry, how to get the right people in, and then once they're in, how to keep them in and how to move up. So a key topic, given we are told we have a cybersecurity skills gap. This will be interesting to discuss. We have a great panel to talk to us today about this. We have JJ Davey, who is cybersecurity ethical hacker and blue team expert at Knox Cyber. We also have Amanda Finch, who's chief executive of the Chartered Institute of Information Security. It's a couple of great panelists to come. I want to welcome though first our first guest, who is a regular attendee at Tice Talks and is now on the panel himself. Please welcome Danny Dresner, who is Professor of Cybersecurity at the University of Manchester and is going to be discussing the topic with us today. Danny, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. It's one of those days where if the tie doesn't tie correctly the first time, you just give up and wear a cravat. So as you can see, today is a good day.
Fantastic. So you actually, because I normally do wear a bow tie, but I figured if we were both wearing bow ties, it would look like some kind of benefit gig. And I thought that would be a bit odd. But you tie them, you actually tie them, because I've mastered it a couple of times, but it's one of those skills that unless you keep practicing it, it drops out your head pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, but I also kind of feel it's like a little bit of a fraud. It's like those ones that they used to give you at school, which I never were quite sure whether it was because they didn't think you could either tie a tie or they were too worried about you strangling somebody with it. Maybe that says something about the kind of school I went to.
We've been watching Line of Duty, and I had to point out to my wife that obviously all police officers now wear clip-on ties so that you can't do exactly that, you know, grab the tie and suffocate the guy as he's arresting you.
I thought most policemen, police officers seem to wear these T-shirt jobs now anyway.
Yes, yeah, and combat trousers and stuff. It's all dressed down, isn't it? It's all gone downhill. That's the issue we've got.
Everyone looks like a SWAT team.
Welcome, Danny. What's the situation? We should actually start. What's the situation at the University of Manchester at the moment? Because obviously it's summer term now, so presumably you wouldn't have many students in. But how's COVID and everything affected you? What's been your setup?
As you can imagine, it's been quite a kind of a mixture. Everybody's been on the starting blocks because you keep expecting this to be kind of quite short term. But what's actually happened is that essentially, I mean, I haven't been in my office since March of last year. The forensic analysis would prove this, you see, because if you went in there, you'd see that the calendar's still on John Pertwee. But there you go. I've been very lucky because obviously in this field, I mean, if you need a wet lab, as they're politely called, it's a completely different situation. Yeah. But with computer science, it's fine as long as you've got a good connection. what we've learned, or certainly what I've learned, maybe this is a personal journey, is finding out, you make so many assumptions. You think that a student of computer science is going to have their own laptop or whatever and a good connection. None of this can be assumed. Sometimes they have to share their equipment with siblings. Sometimes they don't have the decent connections. Then, of course, you've got the challenges of the different time zones for different students as well. But I'm really pleased the way that people have kind of knuckled down and actually connected and engaged. To a certain extent, I've found that whereas sometimes kind of, traditional lectures, difficult to get people to attend and the like, of course, you might be uncharitable and think that they're switching on their browsers and turning off their cameras and they've gone off to do something else. But I personally have certainly found attendance better. I found engagement to be very, very similar. And now the work I do, I try to simulate as much as possible kind of real world collaborative opportunities. The students usually start by hating me, and then most of them like it at the end, and they see the point of having to negotiate and work and understand the problems with a diverse bunch of people who they've been thrown in with, different cultures and different ideas, and that can actually be very beneficial. And that actually has worked very much online. I mean, statistically speaking, I had 13 groups, which was interesting in itself. Last year on my main module, which looks at system security from a governance point of view, I had about 50 students. This year I had over 90. And so we had the challenge of organizing that number of groups. And out of the 13 groups we had, only one group kind of, I suppose, misinterpreted some of the instructions.
Right. So how's it going to work? How do you think it's going to work next year? I mean, let's fast forward to, September. Potentially you can hang on to those numbers by offering sort of more virtual courses. But is the idea, look, let's try and go back to the system where everybody, turns up in person. What do you think is going to happen in September?
Well, ideally it would be nice to see everybody in person, but there are going to be some people who will not want to. I think, unfortunately, with the world the way it is at the moment, maybe something fantastic will happen and, things will hugely improve by then. But I think there are going to be some students who will not want to or actually can't make the journey to Manchester. So we are challenged now to create an environment which will suit both. And to a certain extent, like I said, I like to try and simulate kind of the I suppose this is a terrible term to use in academia, the real world, and I try to engage people in kind of group work and collaborative working and the like, and we are not going to go from a perfect classroom learning situation out into business or industry or charity or whatever it might be, where you have got kind of a nice sort of sterilized, computerized working environment. You're going to have that blended environment. So I think it's a sort of thing that we shouldn't see as a problem, but we should actually embrace it as an opportunity. So, like Douglas Adams always used to say about the 20 stone person running towards you. You make that 20 stone their problem, not yours, when you actually throw them. So, I think the idea of blended learning, some students being in the class, some students being at home in Manchester, some people being at home in different time zones. I think that becomes the opportunity. That, as well as learning the three laws of cybersecurity or whatever, and the five cyber essentials, that actually the humanity and the collaboration across those different media become the great chance that we've actually got.
It's interesting. Yeah, you're right. So the teaching environment sort of mirrors the environment you'd be at in the real world, where in the outside world. The world of commercial work, where you're working at home a bit and you're working in the office a bit. We've had some. Entries come in for a royal-themed cyber pun. Georgia, Her Royal Majesty securing her royal domain. I like that. JJ's gone for On Her Majesty's Secret Server. That's great. I don't know whether you're allowed to win, though, Jay, because you're on a panelist. And Darren's gone for One Security Ring to Rule Them All. Love it. The Cloud Jewels, Georgia's gone for as well. On fire, Georgia, this morning with the puns. Danny, forgive me. I don't know the situation at Manchester. So do you have a pure cybersecurity course, or is cybersecurity taught as part of computer science or whatever?
It's taught as part of computer science. Right. When I started it was sort of the early noughties, and when I was working for the National Computing Center, and I used to come along and say on an industrial liaison panel and say, you're not teaching enough about security. It wasn't cyber in those days, it was computer security, and then it became computer and network security, and now it's cyber security. But I used to say, you're not teaching enough. And then eventually said, okay, well, you come and do it then. And it's grown like that. But we've always taken this opportunity to try and embed it within other courses.
What do you think of the pure cybersecurity courses then? Because obviously they are offered, no GCHQ or NCSC probably approved cybersecurity courses. For somebody going into the industry, do you think that's a good bet, or do you think there's advantages to doing it as part of a general computer science degree?
Both. I mean, and I think this is the important thing. We will always need and we'll always want specialists. Mm. We will want generalists. And I had a discussion with a colleague of mine. I mean, I was saying, having 50, 60, 80, it's lovely having loads of students until it's marking time, of course. and then that really becomes part of the challenge. And one of my colleagues said that, we really ought to up the entry requirements for the course. So we'd have only, what might be termed as the best students, whether entry requirements is a way of finding who your best students are. That's another discussion, one we might end up having in our group, of course. And I said, no, I mean, I don't want anybody to fail. I don't want anybody to do badly. But the more people who are exposed generally to issues in cybersecurity and what to do about them, both from a preparatory and a protective point of view and a recovery and a coping point of view, they may not go into what we would label a cybersecurity career, but they could be in a place in their organization or just in their family in 10 years' time. And that decision will make an enormous difference to many lives.
Yeah. You talked about, we chatted about this in our sort of preparation for this panel, but you talked about that, you have a handful of students who you described just get it. What do they get? What is it about them that's different?
That they do not expect just to walk in and be spoon-fed. To be told the 133 controls from ISO 27001, and this is how you build a security management system. That handful of students are the ones who, every convention, every conference that you go to, all of a sudden you'll actually see them there in the audience. That you'll see, better still, you'll go and see them actually talking to people. They'll actually make contacts. I'll hear from my network, we met one of your students last week. And it's them realizing that this is a dynamic. It's a dynamic. It's talking and understanding. I mean, I know we'll have Amanda from the Chartered Institute. One of the best things that the Chartered Institute have is this model of cybersecurity, where kind of it breaks things down, not just in the subject matter, because we'll always be remodeling kind of the lists and the sub and what you need to know. Mm-hmm. But it recognizes that there's kind of like you'll get kind of your expert level. There's some people who might need to work with supervision. And then sometimes it's just like, you're aware of a thing, and that being that aware of a thing means that, oh yes, I need to talk to and work with other people, because I know there are a few kind of genius out there and I don't know how they do it, and I feel extremely envious of their ability not only to take in the knowledge but also to be apply it. But one of the many amongst things like you've got to protect your crown jewels is also that this cybersecurity is a team sport. This is how I work, and that it's seeing those students who feel that they want to dabble and talk and ask questions and not just sit in the class, get the exercises and score the points.
Yeah, interesting. As you say, they'll do well when they go out into the world of work and have to collaborate in terms of those teams. We're getting some great royal puns, by the way. Abigail's royally owned. Martin Hopkins has gone for red team, blue team, it's in your blood. Alan's gone Latin on us, Regnum defende Cirrus. And Abigail again has gone the white hat, the black hat, the queen's hat. Fantastic. And you mentioned crown jewels there, Danny, as well. So I don't know whether you possibly get a mug as well. I was trying to look at stats on this. I'm going to put a link in the chat. This is the government's research on cybersecurity skills and the skills gap and further and higher education. There was a stat, a quote in there, and again, I'll paste this one in, because it says, around two thirds of graduates from cybersecurity degree courses progress to an entry level role in cybersecurity, which I thought was interesting, or IT. So that was interesting. So some of the graduates who are, you know, graduating from this don't end up doing cybersecurity. They go off and do sort of other careers as well. In your experience, Danny, how many of your sort of cybersecurity pods end up doing cybersecurity? Do you know that?
I don't know. I imagine it's fewer than that particular stat. I mean, we do get the full spectrum. You know, like I say, there's that kind of, you know, that handful of students who, as I've kind of sort of used the phrase, totally get it. But it's also, remember, what we're teaching, we have kind of, you know, very kind of hardcore cybersecurity modules of risk and pen testing and all of that kind of stuff. But we're embedding it amongst all the other topics because... Mm-hmm. If everybody did all our computer science and our IT right, to kind of generalize it a lot, and we all know that generalizations are always false, we wouldn't have a cybersecurity challenge in the first place. Mm. So it's perhaps not necessarily a good thing if we're looking for everybody to kind of leave and go into cybersecurity. A bit like, I mean, I started off in quality management, and I remember somebody saying, "Oh, this is good. You know, we'll follow all the processes and procedures, work on quality. And we might need to actually think about what it is that we're doing in the first place." Mm-hmm. Cybersecurity is like good writing; it should be invisible, mm-hmm. Which is why it's so difficult to measure and why we only kind of notice it when it's causing us a bit of heartache.
But we have, I mean, you know, everybody tells us we've got this cybersecurity skills gap. You know, I would have thought cybersecurity courses would be, you know, full to the gills with people, you know, wanting to do this. It's not a guaranteed job, but it's a pretty good bet that, you know, you're going to be required. Have you seen that? Has there been, you know, is there constant demand, a lot of demand for the cybersecurity bits?
I think the problem is we keep calling it a skills gap, and that's because we keep making, you know, lists and more lists of all the things that you actually that you actually need to know, as opposed to really valuing kind of people's attitude and their approach and their keenness for the subject and preparing them. For some, I mean, this is me, a university person, saying this. Firstly, degrees aren't for everybody. Formal qualifications aren't for everybody. So I think the important thing is understanding how to nurture the talents. Mm. The actual learning and the other stuff can actually follow. We can actually bring things up. We've got to recognize that people, you know, where people have had other jobs. I mean, the advert for the position with the Queen. For a moment, just to go back to Punland, if they're looking for a qualification, presumably they'll have to be Corgi registered. But there we go. But the problem there, you know, they were saying, you know, degree or equivalent and 5 years experience, etc., etc., which is very hardcore HR talk, which is going to channel a lot of people down a particular route and exclude an awful lot of people. I mean, I'm thinking about people coming out of the forces who won't have those qualifications, won't have the audit trail of their skills and evidence, but are going to be absolutely perfect for a role like that. And aptitude is so valuable. And I think we need to find ways of embracing those aptitudes and embracing those attitudes and running with them, because let's face it, our adversaries don't sit there and say, "Well, I'm sorry, but you can only come on this heist with 5 years experience in a degree."
That's really interesting. So yeah, it's a really interesting point that, and I'll bring the panelists in a second, other panelists to talk about that. But yeah, it's interesting that we have a skills gap because what we're measuring is skills and we've got a gap in them. We maybe don't have an aptitude gap, but we're not measuring aptitude, so we don't acknowledge it. Really interesting stuff. I want to bring in our other two panelists on this. They both come at this from different but equally important and equally interesting aspects of this. We've got JJ Davey, who is cybersecurity ethical hacker and blue team expert, Knox Cyber, I'm also going to be welcoming Amanda Finch, who is Chief Executive at the Chartered Institute of Information Security. Welcome to you both. And Amanda, can I come to you first? Because I was looking at one of the talks you did, and you you said you started out with was it Marks and Spencer's you started out with?
Yes, that was a long, long time ago. And my journey started when it was called computer security as well. And I fell into it because I didn't duck quick enough. I was bored and I spoke to the exec and I said, I don't like what I'm doing at the moment. He said, oh, we've got this thing called computer security. And I went, what's that? And he said, I don't know. We've been told by the board we've got to have a function and you like doing new stuff. Get on with it. And that was it. And I started off doing boot detector viruses in those days, and it's come to where it is now. So
Yeah. You said you. I think you said you went to the pub with the IT team, and they were good fun. And so you decided.
Oh, they were great fun. That's how I ended up in IT. My career journey is never planned. I didn't intend to do this job either. I came to a crossroads with my work and sort of looking for something new to do, and they sent me over to the IT group because we've recently taken it in from being a bureau. So that shows you how long ago it was. And they wanted to get some M&S-y type people over there. And I had no idea what anyone was doing. But we went to the pub at lunchtime and I thought, this is fun. I don't know what we do, but this could be fun. And rest is history.
Good. So, and quickly, I mean, the Chartered Institute was, it's changed. It was, I forget the acronym, but it's now changed to the Chartered Institute. Yeah. What's the big difference there? What difference does chartering make, I should say?
Well, I think it makes us growed up, basically, is that the Institute was set up back in about 2006, because at that stage, it was a smallish club, mainly, sadly to say, of men. There weren't many women in it, and people tended to know each other, certainly in the early 2000s, and suddenly there were more qualifications that were coming in, like CISC and things like that, and people were saying that they were security experts, but they didn't necessarily have the experience. So that was one of the reasons that IISP was set up, to act as a focal point for the profession, be able to accredit people for their skills as well as their knowledge, and that has always been something really, really important to us, is that you should be able to demonstrate that you can actually apply the knowledge within the workplace, and hence the levels of our skills framework, which explains whether you're a junior practitioner or a senior practitioner in that particular skills area.
And really, we
felt that it was time we had a professional body. So the chartering of that is actually taking us to being a proper professional institute, and a proper professional, well, a proper profession in effect. Yeah. And people are recognising that it is up there with medicine, law, and all of those other professions.
We'll come back to some really interesting stuff to unpack on that as well. But I want to come over to Jay and just talk about, because you're, again, a bit like Amanda, you sort of kind of stumbled into the industry. You're an ex-military background.
Yeah, that's correct. I always had quite a technical mind, and when I left the military, I went into just a general service desk role. Then I left that role because I just wanted to seek out a new challenge. And a recruiter called me saying, I've got this role for a SOC analyst. And I went, what the hell is a SOC analyst? So he turned around, he explained to me what a SOC analyst was. I'd done my own research. And I thought, that sounds interesting. He went, well, it's a graduate position. I don't know if you'll be able to do it because you haven't really got a degree or anything like that. I said, but I'll put your name forward anyway and see what happens. And now I'm here. So I got offered the kind of position, and I just realized that it was trial by fire and so much to learn. And that's how I kind of fell into cybersecurity, was just that general talk with that recruiter to say, actually, I'm interested. I think I can do it. And I didn't actually, I experienced a tiny bit of gatekeeping there when it came to trying to get into that role. But overall, it wasn't that much of a bumpy road than I thought it was going to be. So it was quite interesting.
But how did you manage that? Because, I mean, Abigail's made a comment there, and Abigail, my heart goes out to you. I'm so sorry to hear about what's happened with your interviews, and we all wish you best of luck, and we hope you keep trying. But it's I know it's demoralising. I mean, Jay, how did you, given that you didn't have, you know, the degree and the qualifications and so on, how did you get that first SOC role? What do you think made them go for you?
I think it was just the kind of demonstrating the passion and the interest. And also being seen by the right people. So I, as soon as I discovered what company it was, I reached out to the hiring manager just to explain to him my situation and say, hey, look, I've come from the military. This is my background. You know, this is what I'm currently studying. So I said, I'm currently studying Network Plus and I'm learning all the content. And we just had a phone call, just a general phone call. And he said, okay, let's go forward. And the recruiter called me up saying, okay, they want to go forward with the interview. Now, the interview wasn't, they had a different interview process for me because I didn't have that graduate level qualification. So they gave me a technical test. They gave me a set of 50 questions and they said, we want to try and benchmark you and measure what you can do. So they gave me 50 questions. And then at the end, they gave me a challenge to write an email to a customer that has this particular problem. So they're trying to see if I have that professional skill element as well. So I think the biggest challenge is being seen by the right people and not just being seen as another CV coming through a machine. Is making sure that you're seen by the hiring manager and the people making that decision.
Interesting stuff. Thanks for that, Jay. And Amanda has commented, I think she's right, Abigail. If the interview goes that badly and they're that horrible, you wouldn't want to work for that company. That'd be my advice as well. Danny, this is interesting. So Jay's story kind of taps into what you were talking about in terms of, you know, what he's demonstrated there is an aptitude, and actually aptitude plus communication skills, rather than, you know, can you program in these languages? Have you used this particular kind of piece of software? That seems to sort of reflect what you were saying about aptitude, not skills necessarily.
I lost the end of you there, but I was thinking, you know, particularly, you know, looking at Abigail's poor experience as well. There is a lot. I mean, you know, perhaps part of the gap is perpetuated by this awful gatekeeping, or certainly perceived gatekeeping by people. I mean, one of the things I show terrible, probably copyright issues. There's a Monty Python sketch where they bring the pregnant woman into the operating theatre, or sorry, the delivery room, and she says to the doctor, "What do I do?" And he says, "Nothing. You're not qualified." and I think there's an awful lot of this about preventing people from being encouraged to learn, encouraged to actually take things up. You know, we've got the new UK Cybersecurity Council, and that is going to be very challenged to make sure that the path to whatever, you know, kind of is labelled a professional is as welcoming as possible. Because, you know, as we codify what you need to know, it's very difficult to be also say, well, this is everything in the body of knowledge, but these are the areas that you can focus on. Just perhaps be aware of some of these other ones. And actually, you don't need to be an expert in everything. And it's that collaboration and cooperation. And I was actually—I'll be very honest and very candid in a public forum and all that. I was extremely worried about how the UK Cybersecurity Forum would go, but I am extremely buoyed by the fact that it's actually being chaired by the person who, as the saying goes, because CJ might have said, has got me to where I am today. Because many years ago, I went to a thing, and there was a woman called Claudia Nadenson was giving a talk. And to quote another friend of mine, I looked at her and said, that's who I want to be when I grow up. and now she is chairing the council. And I think that they will embrace now the real challenge of bringing all kinds of diversity, thought, thinking, culture, gender, you know, real diversity, not just kind of, pigeonholed boxes to tick and the like, not just in the types of people who will be able to get involved, but also that they will be able to and encouraged to travel along the pathways. They will be valued while they're making the journey, which is so important as well. And it will be more of a collaborative nature. I didn't mention neurodiversity as well. You know, we just must remember that this is a complex problem. I'm not saying that accountancy, and I'm certainly not saying that medicine is are simple, but they're fairly focused. We haven't even defined what security, you know, what cybersecurity is yet. We haven't even defined how to solve the problem. Or even what the kind of what the kind of person is. If you look at the National Institute for Standards and Technology in the States, they've identified 52 roles. And I mean, showing my age now, but I think that's like you should that should be like Woolworths. You pick and mix parts of those roles for yourself, and actually, you know, maybe pick roles as well for your organization or groups of organizations, because no one organization is going to be safe by itself.
Just it's interesting that I want to pick up with you on some of the stuff that Danny's talked about there. I mean, I can see the logic and the way you're going in terms of, look, let's put this on a proper footing. Let's actually learn some lessons from areas like law and accountancy and medicine and so on. But what about Danny's point there, the fact that we're still sort of feeling our way in this? How secure can you be in terms of these are the skills you need and this is the accreditation we'll do at the point where cybersecurity is still so new and we're still sort of learning our way?
I think the thing is that it is a very, very young profession, and it's also a very, very fast moving area. If you look at what's happened in the last 10, 15 years, just take cloud, for example, that we were all talking about it passionately about 10 years ago, and now it's just meat and milk with what we do. I think the other problem is that we've also got an incredibly diverse landscape, because you've got so many different, well, every company needs to be involved in it, every individual needs to be involved in it in terms of protecting their own environment. So it's actually quite hard to categorize things as roles, because what may be a specialism and a role in one big organization, you might go to a much smaller organization and you've got somebody that's having to spin about 10, 15 plates and have a completely different profile. So a lot of it is adapting, which is one of the reasons that we look at skills, because skills can make up roles rather than actually sort of saying this is a standard CISO role, because a CISO in one company can be something completely different in another company. So it's a hard thing to actually quantify in that way. The one thing that you can quantify is levels of skill, which is what we do at the Institute. So we have a whole raft of skills that go from everything from security management to pen testing to secure operations and everything around, everything basically. And what we do is that we say, you may know a little bit about it, which is a level one. You may know to do some practitioner level, which is a level three. But you may be an absolute expert at it at a level six. And I think it's understanding the abilities from there of what you need for particular roles. But for people coming into the profession, that's really hard, because we don't signpost things particularly well. And I think you would like to ask a supplementary question.
I was going to ask Jay about that, actually, because as somebody who's a relatively new entrant into this, obviously, you started from a position of not knowing what a SOC was. How easy was it then? How easy has it been since then to go, okay, these are the skills that I need, these are the accreditations and qualifications? Because I see all these different qualifications, all these different bodies. How have you navigated this and worked out that's the one that's worth going for, that's the one I'll pay for?
So for me, it was a mixture of my own research and talking to people that are already in the industry and getting their kind of advice, putting it into a bag and just picking out what the most common theme is between the people. You're going to get really bad advice. So you're going to get somebody that's going to say to you, you just want to get into cybersecurity, well, do this, but doesn't realize it has a 5-year requirement, which you don't currently have, obviously, because you're trying to get into the field. And then you have people with a bit more realistic advice, whether they tell you to go for a CCNA or for a Net Plus, just to build that kind of networking foundation if you're going for a technical role. So a lot of it is about doing your own research. And I think that's part of the reason why I've done quite a lot of the stuff that I've done so far with the mentoring and building the careers help pages, is just trying to help people see that wood through the trees and understand what is the next step for them, and giving them that kind of tool set that they require to be able to do their own research.
Yeah. Can we, I wondered if our, we have our Tice elf, by the way, for those of you who don't know, who beavers away in the background and is merrily putting in links and stuff to people's LinkedIn profiles and so on. So thank you for that. I wonder if our Tice elf, if we could do a poll on this. I'm just interested in this idea of skills versus aptitude. So I guess the poll question would be, you know, what's more important in cybersecurity careers, skills or aptitude? Let's put that out there and see what people say. That will be in the polls section on the right hand side. So stick in your votes and we'll see where we go from that. Jay, I want to come back to you just on the on what you talked about there. The money is important as well, because there's different costs for all these things. You know, how do you weigh up what ones are worth the money?
So the surefire way of doing that is just searching through job descriptions, picking out which comes up the most common. So what are the most common certifications that are looked for across the region that you're applying for? So for the UK, what is the most common certification that comes up for the job that you desire? So if you want to be a SOC analyst, let's look through about 20, 30 SOC job descriptions and understand which one is the most common. So you'll probably see Security Plus or Network Plus come up really common at the junior levels, but towards the mid-level and senior levels, you're going to see stuff like CISP and CCNA and CCNP come up. So it's all about kind of like weighing out the pros and cons. So, you know, this certification, you know, someone may say, oh, it hasn't really got a good body of knowledge, but it's very well recognized in the UK cybersecurity industry. So it may be worth going for just purely because it gives you that kind of visibility that you require to get through any ATS systems or to, you know, pique the interest of a hiring manager. Because the hiring manager is only going to baseline your skills based on the certifications that you have, unless they have a technical testing element to it. So if you apply for a role and you don't have a networking certification, they're probably not going to find out that you have that networking ability, and they're probably going to disregard your application for that role because somebody else has that certification that benchmarks their current skill level in that domain.
And this is, Amanda, this is the problem, isn't it? That you could have two companies who are basically looking for effectively the same type of person, but this company over here wants this accreditation or this exam or this particular skill proof, and this company over here wants a different one. And as a job applicant, if you've got one and not the other, you can't apply for both those companies. Do you see what I mean? It's tricky at the moment.
I think it's really hard because often the hiring managers don't really understand what they're actually hiring for, especially when you're looking at the senior levels. And you see these ridiculous job adverts where they're looking for what I call unicorn people that have got everything. And actually, you don't really want to hire somebody that's overqualified for that particular job because they're just going to move on in a couple of years. So there's a lot that we need to do as a profession about really signposting better and all of those things. And it's a bit of a lottery. Yeah.
In an ideal world, Amanda, is that what you want to do for the Chartered Institute? Is to basically be the sort of central gold standard, you know, to lay this out and to, you know, for you guys to be the kind of, you know.
I mean, this is why we put a lot of store by people being able to demonstrate experience. So we're completely agnostic with our membership levels of what background is, whether it's a degree background or whether it's, you know, sort of formal classes through commercial courses or if it's learned experience on the job. The important thing is to be able to apply that skill in the workplace and be able to apply it professionally. So what we're trying to do at the moment is that we're trying to define pathways for people coming into the profession. So we're very happy to support people in the early stages. We have something called an Associate Development Programme, which takes people that are completely new and we expose them to all areas of our skills framework. So they can actually understand how those skills are applied within the workplace. But also they get a chance to actually see whether they like that sort of skill, because we all start somewhere and we all end up in completely different places. And the thing is to really support people so that they can go to the next step. And yes, that we recognise training courses, we recognise university degrees, we recognise particular qualifications. And
if somebody's been through CISP, you would recognise that, for example, that would be something that would, you would take
absolutely
account of.
Absolutely. So the if somebody's got a managed CISP, you know, they've done the 5 years experience, they can claim associate membership with us away. So that's fine. And we do that with other qualifications on a knowledge basis and things. So we're trying to recognise, and where we would like people to recognise the post-nominals that we use, because everybody that's been through that system has been reviewed by professionals, so it's all done through peer review. And Danny is one of our esteemed fellows, has reviewed other people as well. So hence I've got the staff on, so that I'm not putting you down in my appearance.
Can I stay with you, Amanda, for a second? Because you made a good point about the sort of unicorn. I love that idea, the unicorn job ad, where it's like, yeah, we want somebody who does this, 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 and this, and can do it on a unicycle.
Absolutely backwards, in heels.
But talking about in heels, you made a good point about how men and women approach job adverts when we were talking about this. Run me through that again. How does that work?
Oh, gosh. Basically, men will go for a job advert if they see about 40% of it is a fit. Women are far more cautious, and that they will only go for something if they think that there's a pretty good fit. An 80% fit is the number that gets thrown out there. I don't know how some of these statistics come together, but that is a problem, that a lot of the recruitment is putting off large proportions of the population, and that we need to couch job adverts in a far more inclusive way.
I think that's interesting. I think certainly for me as a journalist, I do get the feeling that when I approach people for interview, if I approach male IT security people, even though they don't know what I say, oh, doing a piece about, I don't know, ransomware, you know, could you do an interview? Yes, yeah, I'll do an interview. Generally, if I approach female IT security people, I think sometimes the reaction, I'm second guessing this, but I think sometimes the reaction has been, well, I'm not an expert on ransomware. And I'm thinking, well, neither is this guy over here, but he doesn't mind. He'll bone up on the knowledge and the way into the studio. By the way, our poll has been interesting. So what's more important for cyber careers, aptitude, skills, or both? Obviously, 56% of people went for both aptitude and skills, but forced to make a decision. Interestingly, 28% of people said aptitude's more important, and only 11% said skills are more important. So, Danny, that does seem to answer your question. And actually, talking of questions, John has come up with a question, which I'm going to put on screen now, which I think is an interesting one. This comes up in a lot of conversations. CISOs don't need the networking programming skills. They need soft skills, communication, etc. How do we help wannabe CISOs develop these skills? Danny, can you give some tips on that?
I'm definitely a stock record on this one. First fault is we mustn't call them soft skills. They are not soft skills. They are core skills.
Absolutely.
We should encourage everybody to work to have them, whether they're management or technical. But also, we shouldn't try and shower them on somebody whose skill is just sitting by a box, taking it apart, putting it back together, setting it up for other people. Because that is, you know, that's their aptitude, that's their niche, that's their contribution. So the original Greek is about steering. We need to steer the profession towards the people and the people towards the profession. We need to stop trying to nail things down into pigeonholes because we are totally failing to navigate. And it's because we're doing that, of course, our adversaries are able to jump in between the cracks. We're arguing over what is cybersecurity and you know what we should, you know, the sexy acronym for our project. The criminals aren't thinking, okay, well, you know, here, we need a really good code name before we can go on this particular attack.
Interesting stuff. James has come in. The rise into cyber management can often support the Peter Principle, which, if you're not familiar with the Peter Principle, I think it's the idea that you get promoted in an organization on the basis of time served, not competence. So ultimately, incompetent people tend to rise to the top. Not that says anything about our current government or anything. But Jay, I just want to come back to you. We're sort of slightly short of time, but this idea of communication skills, the interview process you talked about was really interesting because one of the things they were testing was, can you explain this stuff to a customer, to a client? As you've worked then in the industry, has that still been the case? Are those explanatory skills and communication skills constantly coming up? Or was that just something that happened in the interview and actually day to day, you don't really, you know, need it or use it?
So when I was SOC level one, I was non-existent talking to customers. It was a couple of emails here and there. But then when I've started to become more advanced in my career and progress more, I've been talking to clients a lot more, face-to-face interview, face-to-face discussions with them, and explaining technical things to non-technical people. So you need to be able to explain those technical concepts to different levels of technical abilities without being, you know, condescending and insulting. You need to be able to explain it in a way that they understand. So you get that ability to translate tech to business, because that's, at the end of the day, that's what that is. It's a business. You're talking to a business. So being able to talk to stakeholders comes in time. And it's, you will start to learn harsh lessons. When you say the wrong thing, you're going to get the wrong reaction. You're going to get the reaction that you weren't looking for. And that's possibly the best way to learn. I've had it plenty of times where I've said something and it's come across as insulting. And I think that's the way that you really kind of dial in the way you talk to people, is just going out and trying it. Try to explain technical subjects to your parents and learn, you know, how do you talk to different stakeholders?
It's interesting. There is no textbook for communication, and I say that as a journalist. So, listen, we're coming to the end of our session here. We've had Myra, apologies if I got the pronunciation wrong, has sent us... I think this wins the mug. This is a God Save the Queen cybersecurity twist. Before I read that out, I will thank our panelists. Thank you so much, Danny Dresner, Professor of Cybersecurity, University of Manchester, JJ Davey, Cybersecurity Ethical Hacker and Blue Team Expert at Nox Cyber. Their LinkedIn profiles are in the chat, along with that of Amanda Finch, who's Chief Executive at the Chartered Institute of Information Security. Thank you to all of you. Mir, I will try and sing this now. From every blatant foe, from the assassin's APT blow, CISO save the Queen. Over her thine disarm extend, for Britain protect, operate, defend, our insider threats no friend. CISO save the Queen. Thank you. I would have stood, but like most of our attendees, I'm not wearing trousers. So thank you so much to all of our attendees. Thank you to our panelists. Thank you to you folks for getting involved in the chat. Abigail, stick with it. There are lovely people in cyber. We shall see you again.